I was thinking maybe we can start with some questions that might not have been asked yesterday. So do you have any questions about the theory of a free scalar in two dimensions? It's all clear? Crystal clear? No worries? OK. So I can assume you had that Fock space in mind, the Hilbert space, and we can start using it. OK. So the purpose of today's lecture is to figure out the string spectrum. We're going to start doing things by hand in a somewhat intuitive manner. And then between the end of this lecture and next lecture, we'll start introducing ghosts to do things properly with VRST quantization. So as you may remember from previous lectures, we started from some Namagoto action. We made into a Polyakov action with an auxiliary metric. We gauge fixed the metric to get a theory of free scalars, which tell you where the string is in space-time. And when you gauge fix the metric is almost gone, but the equations of motion for the metric are still there. So classically, if you were to try to treat the system classically, you would say, OK, I study classical solutions of these free equations of motion, subject to the constraint that the stress tensor vanishes. And this is actually a pretty nice classical problem you want to study. So you can say, OK, I want to study this sort of equations with a constraint. Let me just write it holomorphically. Now, we're not going to try to do this, but it's actually a pretty fun system. You know, this is a system which describes what? Describes surfaces of minimal area in flat space. Because remember, we started with an action which was just the area. We manipulated it. We got something out of it. Even classically, that's a nice problem, you know, find sub-bubbles in space-time. And this is a way to solve that problem. You can, although it's a pretty nonlinear problem, you can reduce it to these linear equations of motion plus some quadratic constraints. Now we want to do the same for these quantum string theory strings. The main question is how to impose this classically, what is the quantum analog of imposing these classical equations of motion, of imposing the stress tensor vanishes? I don't know, you probably did quantization of gauge fields, I assume. Right, so you saw something like called Gupta-Bloor quantization, where you had to impose that. So classically, you wanted to impose conservation of the conservation laws, sorry, the vanishing of the charge. And quantum mechanical, you took the modes of your current and of your constraint, and you impose only positive modes would kill your physical states. So we can try to do something like that. We can take the stress tensor.
When you calculate the dx for the current, that isn't that all the results come from the classical equation? Like why did they quantize?
So as I said, the proper way to do things would be to let me say this properly. The equation of the classical equations of motions have a meaning in the quantum field theory too. They hold when inserted inside correlation functions up to contact terms at the location of other operators. So it should be still true that in the original action we were studying, the insertion of the stress tensor inside the correlation function should be zero. So quantum mechanically, we need. Now, as I said, I'm going to do VRST quantization later, which is a much better way to arrive to these statements. For now, I would just like to give the rougher sort of statements. So you want your physical state, so the property, the expectation value of the stress tensor on them vanishes. And one reasonable way to make it happen is that you expand your stress tensor in modes, which, well, you already had the expression in the previous lecture. So extract the Fourier modes of the stress tensor. And you can say, OK, I want my physical states to be annihilated by the modes with positive energy. I will have to do something about the zero mode. Remember, there was a contribution from the Casimir energy. And I'm going to leave that a little bit undetermined here, because it's something that really can only be fixed properly doing BRST quantization. There is a contribution to this that comes from the measure, from the metric over the diffeomorphism time while, which to be computed properly, which you cannot compute properly in this hand-waving way of doing things. So for now, I just put a number here. I will tell you later what the number should be. We'll see what does it imply. Anyway, so I can try to impose these constraints on the physical states. And dually, on the dual states, sorry, I meant, okay. So these conditions will make it so that when I sandwich the stress tensor between physical states, it will vanish because the positive modes will kill the thing on the right and the negative ones, things on the left. Yes?
A is a Casimir energy here?
Yes, it's a Casimir energy. It, based on yesterday's lecture, you would say, OK, this must be minus dimensional space time over 24. This answer is not quite right because there are extra contributions from the metric, which will have to be adjusted. No, remember, it was just the definition I gave, right? I said that the modes of, when I was expanding the stress tensor on the cylinder, there was sum of ln e to the ns minus 1 over 24. That minus 1 over 24 becomes minus dimensions over 24 when you have these scalars, but then gets an extra correction from the metric measure. So the stress tensor has an extra correction from the measure of the metric over the diffeomorphism time while. And we'll get to it later on. OK. Now we're almost done. There is one last observation that, as in QED, there are states that take this form. These states might be physical, but they are also orthogonal to all physical states. So a state which is simultaneously null and physical will have zero norm. And it will be orthogonal to all physical excitation, to all other physical states. And so it has to be removed. It's a gauge. It's a pure gauge state. It's completely analogous to a longitudinal photon. This condition is analogous to say, OK, the polarization of my photon has to be orthogonal to the momentum. It's analogous to the statement, if the photon is polarized along the momentum, its a null state has to be removed.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. What is our gauge here? Because I thought the x mu are just some scalars that are living on the screen, right? So in which sense are they, what is our gauge here?
So I'm talking about the, so it's, well, first of all, it's the gauge symmetry we use to gauge fix the metric.
Yeah, but you said in the last lecture that there is no gauge covariant derivative related to the gauge fixing of the metric because the metric
is connected. Sure. That's right. So I'm not saying that this is a gauge field. I'm saying that these are analogous to the states that you encounter when quantizing a gauge field. So there was a gauge symmetry in the system, which was this wild times diffeomorphisms. In a sense, these null states are just fake. They're obtained from they just describe excitations in the direction of these diffeomorphisms or wild transformations, which are not real excitations of the string. They're just fluctuations in our conventional choice of a coordinate system on the string. So the Hilbert space of the string is going to be the space, the Hilbert space of the scalars with the constraint, with this constraint, which is usually called highest weight. Or primary. Of with a property that the L0, which is the called conformal dimension, is A, minus the states in this space, which happen to also be null. Now, this condition is usually called being a descendant. Now, by the way, you might worry, you might start wondering immediately, why is he talking about null states? We had a nice theory of a scalar field on the cylinder. That's a unitary theory, right? There should be the net product should be positive definite. Why are you talking about null vectors at all? You should have asked that question. Well, what's going on is that we're trying to have a relativistic string theory. So we're going to use everywhere this sort of contractions, which are contractions using the Lorentzian metric. So for example, when we compute, when you write down the commutators of the scalar fields, suppose that we start including the Lorentz indices, well, we're going to get delta n plus m eta mu nu. And in particular, when you compute things like this inner product, we're going to find things like eta mu nu delta p minus p prime. Again, this is completely analogous to what you saw when you quantize QED. Because the vector boson carries a Lorentzian index and you're trying to do things relativistically, the norm of states which carry a time index has the wrong sign. So we have a potential problem. The metric is not positive definite. And now you need to start worrying, OK, is this space going to be positive definite? So, or does it have, or is it going to have ghosts? So is this removing everything that can go wrong? Hopefully, yes. OK, now. First of all, are we going to remove anything? Are there going to be any null states? For example, Is it possible for So it turns out that the presence or absence of null states among the physical states depends very strongly on the choice of A and on the number of dimensions of space-time. So when we're gonna do quantization properly, we're gonna discover that the correct values are A equal to 1 and number of dimensions equal to 26. Oops. Now, I have no way at the moment to tell you why these are the right numbers. But they are kind of nice.
Sorry, I think mm-hmm. this should be down there because if you move it up, it's down there.
Oh, yes, you're right, of course. Thanks. So I would like to show you that these numbers actually have some nice features in terms of null states. They're numbers for which there are a lot of interesting null states to be taken away from the spectrum. For example, suppose I start from some state with a property that has specific eigenvalue of L0 and is annihilated by positive ends. And I consider the first descendant as a possible null state. I can ask, when is this guy physical? Well, let's check. If I act with L2, I can commute it across L minus 1. It annihilates H. The commutator is L1. It annihilates H. OK. Act with L3, with L4, with L5, and so on, I get 0. That's good. The only thing that can go wrong are L1 and minus 1 H, and L0 minus A and minus 1 H. OK? So this is easily computed. I commute it across L1 and minus 1. I get 2 L0, which is 2 H. Well, this is H plus 1, because this changed the value of, then I'm not taking value by 1 unit, minus A. Yeah, actually, perhaps I should make this statement clear. So let me just write the Virasoro algebra again. So let me specialize it to n equal to 0. What I get? Okay. So they essentially tell you that every time you act something with like L minus 1 or in a state, you increase the L0 eigenvalue by 1 unit. Okay. Now, so when is this physical? It's physical if H equals A minus 1 and at the same time equals 0. So A equal to 1 is a particularly nice value of A. It's a value where we find a lot of null states in the spectrum of the form L minus 1 acting on something. Now we can repeat the exercise for something of level 2. So you can ask, under which circumstances something like L minus 2 plus B L minus 1 squared acting on H is physical? So we can write a bunch of equations. We can compute L2, L minus 2 plus B L minus 1 squared H, for example. OK, we can use the commutation relations. I'm not going to do all the steps, but I can do a few of the steps. For example, when I commute L2 across L minus 2, I get L0 for L0. But for the first time, I start getting the central charge into the game, with 2 times 3 over 12. So I get C over 2 plus 4H. And then when L2 acts on L minus 1 squared, I commit across the first L minus 1. I get L1 acting on L minus 1, or L2, or something like the form L minus 1, L2, L minus 1. The last term vanishes, and I get something like this. Then I can compute L1. And L0 minus A. Which is, of course, H plus 2 minus A. OK. So what do I learn? I learned that A, that H should be A minus 2. I learned something about B here. And then I learned something about C here, if I want this to be a physical state. So in particular, we learned that if A equal to 1 and C equal to 26, which means there are 26 dimensions, then this is null. This can be null. OK, so just to say that these numbers have some nice feature, the feature that there are, or some interesting, let's say just interesting feature, the feature that there are a lot of, that given a physical state, I can find null states of one level down or of two levels down. If you take other values of A or C, there will be typically no null states in the physical spectrum, or there will be somewhere else, more sparse. OK. I mean, you're free to say, and so what? It's OK. I just wanted to. I wanted to do this exercise in part because it's useful for you when you learn conformal field theory too. Similar exercises of finding null vectors inside the descendants are used, for example, in defining minimal models. Now, here I did calculations by hand. There is something called the Katz determinant, which tells you exactly what the null vectors are among the descendants of a given primary. And right, if you do two-dimensional conformal field theory, when you encounter the minimal models, you encounter the Katz table, the Katz determinant, and calculations of this sort. Mm-hmm. Which the?
I mean the
dimension. So, is not a coincidence in the sense that the existence of these null states is what makes the BRST procedure work implicitly. So, the BRST procedure will tell us that these are the right values for things to make sense. Concretely, the way these values enter in a variety of calculations done with this BRST formalism, but Yes, I think it's fair to say that the existence of these null vectors is important for the inner workings of the BRST analysis, although you typically don't see it when you do calculations. Yes?
Well, if here a plus 1 and then a just a minus 2, so a just minus 1, would we still call that a null state?
Sorry?
We have here that a just a minus 2 and that
yes.
a plus 1, so
mm-hmm.
a just minus 1, right?
Yes.
Do we still call that a null state?
H itself is not a null state, but this is. So starting from a primary of dimension minus 1, we can get a null state of dimension 1 if C is 26 and A is equal to 1. OK. Anyway, let's now assume these values and do some calculations. So let's look at the Fock space of these 26 free bosons. Find the primaries, find the descendants. So we start with a pure momentum mode. Can you guess when is this going to be a primary? Which conditions do we need to satisfy? Mm-hmm. Does this satisfy the highest weight condition? Unfortunately, I forgot to write down the expression of L in terms of the A's. And I don't have it in the notes, so I hope I don't get my signs wrong. But I think the expression was something like this. Correct me if I'm wrong. Okay, yes. Yes.
Did you define what you meant?
Sorry, a highest weight.
Okay.
I meant, when is this physical?
Okay.
But there are two conditions. It should be highest weight, and it should have, again, value of L naught equal to 1. By the way, I wrote everything for L naught, for the L's. Of course, there are the same equations for the L bars also have to hold. In general, over these lectures, I will typically forget to mention the anthropomorphic stuff. So let's see. Let's look by. Suppose I act with L1 on this. It's pretty clear that this is 1. One of these two is going to be a positive number. But positive A's kill the state. Same for L2, same for L3, same for L4, and so on and so forth. So this is definitely highest weight. Now, when does it satisfy the second condition? If you remember, the eigenvalue of L naught of P was just P squared over 2. So the condition for a physical state of this form is that it should have p squared equal to 2. So we start with some bad news. We have a tachyon in the spectrum. Remember, I'm working the normalization where the space directions have positive sign in the metric. There's nothing to do about this. The bosonic string that we're going to study over the next several lectures is an ill-defined theory. It has some intrinsic instability, which this destroys the vacuum. But it's still a good toy model.
Just because we said a equals 1, right?
Yes, that's right. So I know you might wonder, OK, is there any other way to make a different from 1? Could you get a equal to 0 or negative? Well, no. It follows on the, it's a manifestation of the Weyl anomaly. You can try to push things around, push this anomaly around, but at the end, you always find something going wrong. Let's keep going. At the next level, by the way, could this be null? Clearly not. It has norm 1. But also, it clearly cannot be obtained by acting with negative L's on something else, because negative L's are made with negative A's. So they add excitations on top of these ground states. You cannot get the ground states by adding excitation on top of something. So
when you say negative L, you mean the subscript's negative?
Yes. Yes. So next, we can try to put 1 unit of excitation in this. Now, we want to have the same value of L0 and L0 bar, because both L0 and L0 bar have to be equal to A. Which means if I put in, because the L0 and L0 barring values of the ground states are the same, if I change L0, I better also change L0 bar by the same amount. It's called level matching. So I need to do something like that. OK. So what is L0 acting on this? It's P squared over 2 plus 1. So now, if A is equal to 1, this is a massless particle. Massless particle with two Lorentz indices. Now let's see what constraints. Do we get any other constraints? Is this a physical state? Well, it satisfies L0 equal to A. Now I need to check that it's also annihilated by L1. So let's do the calculation. How do I do this calculation? Well, I need to express this in terms of the A's. I'm going to get something interesting only if I get something that is going to catch this on the way to the ground state. So I can have something like minus A0 mu, sorry, A1 sigma. Acting on this. So it should be easy to convince yourselves that this is the only term in L1 which can do something interesting here. I commute it across, and I get this. A0 acts on P, giving me the momentum. So I end up with P mu, A bar, mu. P. Sorry. I'm doing it. No, that's right. That's right. So let me put some polarization tensor here. OK. OK. Mm-hmm. Sorry, yes. I just add them all up. In a Lorentz invariant way. Sorry. Good point. So this tells me that in order to have a physical state, it's not enough for it to be massless. It also has to satisfy a constraint. This I get from L1, and then there's a constraint from L1 bar. So it has to be transverse. Finally, I can look for null states. I know I can find null states by acting with L minus 1 of something of zero dimension. So I know that I'm going to find a null state by acting with L minus 1 on H, on P, sorry. Actually, for the matching, I'm going to need to do this. I can put something else. The anthropomorphic stuff can go along for the ride, it commutes to the holomorphic stuff, so I can do something like this. Okay. Let's do it. I use the definition again, and I end up with P mu A minus 1 mu A bar mu minus 1. And this is a null state. So I get these states modulo states where the polarization has the form is longitudinal. I need some name here for the gauge transformation. Okay. So what are we talking about? So you get states which carry two Lorentz indices, are transverse, and we get rid of longitudinal null modes. Now, in order to really understand what's going on, it's useful to decompose into irreducible Lorentz representations. You know, a tensor with two indices is not irreducible. But I can do two things. I can symmetrize it, anti-symmetrize it, get rid of the trace, perhaps. So I have something like this. Let me call it symmetric traceless. I'll have some anti-symmetric. And maybe I'll have a trace.
So these states are labeled by P here. Is that labeled by P mu, or is it just one number P that they're labeled by?
Sorry?
These states, which are labeled by P, is the label here, is that the Lorentz vector, or is that just one number?
P is a momentum, sorry. It has, of course, a Lorentz vector too. I'll call it sigma.
Sorry, I didn't catch which states are we looking here for?
Well, these are states in the Hilbert space of these 26 bosons on the cylinder.
Physical states.
And I'm looking for physical states, modulo null states. Right. So these are supposed to be the conditions to have a physical state.
So we don't
of this form. States. And then among the physical states, there are null states of this form, which we need to remember. So the physical excitations of this form will consist of states with this polarization, modulo this gauge transformation.
So this gauge transformation identifies some of these.
That's right. That's a good way to think about it. We are identifying state whose polarization differs by something of this form. Maybe I should have written it like this. There's a gauge symmetry, which allows you to shift the polarization. Again, this should be pretty analogous to what you saw for a photon, for quantizing a photon, right? a photon had a unique, as just one Lorentz index instead of two. It was transverse and defined up to shift by something proportional to the momentum. Now, after you decompose it into irreducible pieces, I guess here I should do something to make sure it's it's transverse. I more or less write it like that. It's a little bit more work is required here. I don't want to do it now. Anyway, so roughly there is some scalar, some true form, and something with true symmetric traceless, true symmetric indices, which are massless and have a gauge symmetry, transverse and have a gauge symmetry.
Okay, so the state A bar P that we're looking at?
Yes.
So the condition on it being physical is that it vanishes under the action of I1, right?
That's right.
So why? It seems like a weaker condition to say that it has to vanish and we contract with epsilon mu nu. Shouldn't it just vanish identically? I don't understand why the polarization came into the argument.
We have the space of the scalars. Inside this space, we're trying to find states that are physical. We are definitely allowed to take linear combinations of states in order to find a physical state. There is nothing special about this particular basis element. I want to look at linear combinations of basis elements looking for a physical one. So I put a generic polarization. Then among these, I find that these linear combinations are good. And these linear combinations are good, but now.
That combination, isn't it comes from the p square equals zero? Like, if p square equals zero, then the four just comes out. But how is it related to that?
No, carefully, because what happens if I contract this with p mu?
Oh.
This vanishes, but this doesn't. So this has to be constrained farther so that it's orthogonal to P. What I was trying to say is this doesn't imply this. I'm really explaining myself poorly. Let me say it properly. Let's look at all states of this form. The ones that satisfy the type of this form are orthogonal to all other ones, and they are null. So we throw them away. You can derive this condition by literally taking these guys and contracting them with somebody else, or more easily by checking if they are of the form L minus 1. Now, it's true that there could be other null states besides the ones of this form. These ones are the ones that are gauge symmetries. These ones really came from acting with diffeomorphisms. See, these are really obtained by acting with the diffeomorphism plus wild transformation on another state. So they're pure gauge. They're not physical. It's a happy fact that after we remove these unphysical states, the remaining states have a positive definite inner product. It was not guaranteed, but it's a nice fact. And it's a theorem called the No-Gauss theorem. That as you keep doing this procedure, you never generate states which have negative norm. Getting rid of these null states is enough to get something good. Okay, so what are these? Can you guess what is this? A state, massless, which Lorentz indices symmetric. Yes, it's a graviton. So this is a graviton. This is something unusual, a true form. It's a generalization of a gauge field, but has two indices, but also has a gauge symmetry. So remember, this one has a gauge symmetry given by that, which infinitesimally looks like that. So if I try to package these modes inside a field satisfying some equation of motion, this field will be invariant under diffeomorphisms in space-time, not to be confused with diffeomorphisms on the worksheet. This one has another kind of transformation, which, as I said, is a generalization of the transformation of a photon. It's called the true form, or the Cabramond field. OK, you can say water that. Exactly. I mean, it's just a field, one of the massless fields of the boson, of the bosonic string. We can look later. I want to say this. So a one-form field like a photon couples to particles, right? If you want to write the action so you literally take the particle and you word line and you integrate your gauge field on the word line, and that gives you the coupling of a particle to a gauge field. This kind of field is a field which is sourced by strings instead.
What is the phenomenon of this gauge field? I mean, what is the corresponding? Vector potential, electrodynamics, if I integrate around a loop, I get one transformation. So what do I get out of this guy?
A generalized U1 transformation. It's actually kind of spin one. Well, I mean, of course, in dimension higher than four, notion of spin is replaced by representation of the little group. So this is not spin two in the same sense in which this is spin two, definitely. This is much the same behavior of a gauge field. and finally there is a scalar field, which is called the dilaton, and which, as I mentioned before, it ends up describing fluctuations of the coupling of the string. So if you want to understand why are these fields here, well, philosophically, the metric is, the graviton is there because the string couples to a metric and wants the metric to be fluctuating. The dilaton is there because you need to be able to make the gauge coupling fluctuate. And this field is there because when you have strings, it's very natural for them to feel a force which couples this form. So to feel a force that roughly look like that, the integral over the string worksheet of B. See, again, you saw differential forms at some point. So this is a true form. It's something naturally gets integrated over surfaces. The same way as one form is something that gets integrated over lines. So for a theory of strings, it was actually quite natural to have to be coupled to something of this form, to a true form. Okay, now of course we can continue this exercise looking at more and more complicated states. For example, the next stage, we have a variety of things we can put on the holomorphic side and on the anti-holomorphic side. So we could look at something that has a minus 1 squared or something that has an a minus 2. So a minus 1 mu, a minus 1 nu, a minus 1 bar mu bar, a minus 1 bar mu bar. You could represent like a minus 2 mu, a minus 1 bar mu, a minus 1 bar mu. Or we should look at general linear combinations of all these states and try to figure out which one are physical and then throw away the ones that are null. Okay. This is a calculation which takes a little bit of time. But the very first observation is these states have p squared equal to minus 2. So they are massive states. They're massive states with a whole bunch of Lorentz indices. Notice that the constraints to be physical and the constraint not to be null will put various linear relations between these fields. I'm not sure it's particularly useful to work them out. But intuitively, as I said, you get null states. In this case, you might get null states by acting with something that has p squared equal to 0 with L minus 1, or with L, or on something that has p squared equal to 2, minus 2. I have them wrong. Anyway, you can start from something that is roughly of this form and act with L minus 1, or something that is roughly of that form, just the ground state, and act with L minus 2. So essentially, what happens is that you end up throwing away combinations of these and stuff in here. Let me see. Yeah, roughly, objects like these end up being null. You're more or less left just with this plus. Roughly, you get something that is traceless symmetric here, times something that is traceless symmetric here. I don't know if it's really worth doing the calculation. Let's just say that there are a whole bunch of Lorentz representations here, massive Lorentz representations here, and a lot of them are removed by the null state condition, and a lot of them are left. So, in particular, there is definitely something left that has four indices. And then this keeps going farther and farther. So in general, you get states which have mass 2n. So the excited states of the strings are particles which have equally spaced masses. Mass squared, they keep going all the way to infinity. Notice there are no units here. Everything is really expressed in terms of the tension of the string, which is what was that number put in front of the action. So there is some scale, and that's intrinsic of the string, and that tells you this mass. Okay. Do you have any questions?
Just one. So there is you have some kind of ordinate, so four index, an object that lives in the Lorentz representation with four indices, but this is the 26 dimensional space time.
Yes.
So this is a huge, humongous amount of field.
Right? Absolutely. Okay. Yes. And it gets worse. I mean, the number of states in the Hilbert space of a free boson grows very fast. Because essentially you get the number of even just for a single free boson, you get the number of partitions of n. Right? You want to go down at level n, you need to put together a minus 1, a minus 2, a minus 3, whatever powers, this number of partitions, which grows fast. Here you have, you can do things essentially with 26 copies of each of these. It grows very fast. Then there is a physical condition, the null states, but essentially you end up having 24 copies of the bosons. Yes, the number of states grows very fast as you, as the level, as the mass grows. Yes.
And then we fix the p to be zero. But what if we start with the primary, like, can we start with the primary, like, a minus 2, b, and then, oh, yeah.
Okay. It's here.
But then here, there, the p need not be zero, right?
Cannot. I mean, if I want this to be physical, okay. I need a 0 equal to a. So p is minus b squared minus 2. So I keep using work primary, right? I just mean highest weight. Yes. Yes. Physical is a bit stronger because it's primary and also a specific eigenvalue of L0. So this is the condition, highest weight, which is also called primary.
And this term has the highest weight. This term has the highest weight.
Sorry?
Yeah, these four states.
Not all of them. I need to take specific linear combinations. So, because I need to make sure that they are killed by L1 and by L2. So, being killed by L1, for example, let's say, suppose I want to check when is this killed by L2. Being killed by L2 will essentially give you the disease transverse again, because L2 will contain an A0, A2 inside. So, I get P contracted with my polarization. But then I also need to check that it's killed by L1. L1 has a term inside which is something like A minus 1, A2. So this will be mapped to something like A minus 1 mu. So I need to take a linear combination between this and this to make it vanish. So, which essentially, right, and so on and so forth. So the physical constraints already cuts down some of this by relating them to others. And then the null state cuts it farther. The gauge symmetries cut it farther. OK, I guess there is no more time to do anything else, so it's a good time to stop.